Well, I march through the storm, and I march through the rain, and I march through some sickness and some heartache and pain. And I laid on the ground, and I looked up at the sky, and I prayed to the Lord up above and asked why. But oh no, I'm not tired, I'm not through marching yet, and I'ma march until I die, oh children, this you can bet. And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on,
I'm gonna march on,
gonna put one foot in front of the other
foot, yes, I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on, got to keep on going,
I'm
yeah.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But does it bend by itself, like a naturally occurring rainbow coming to Earth? Or does it bend when people and social movements grab hold of that arc and bend it toward justice? We will explore this and many other questions in this series, and we invite you to join us on this adventure and exploration of social change. On May 4th of 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War and the protests throughout the country, Ohio National Guardsmen opened fire on peaceful student demonstrators at Kent State University, killing 4 and wounding 9 others. One of those who was wounded was Joe Lewis. Joe was an 18-year-old freshman that year and has carried the scars and trauma with him since that fateful day that changed the lives of so many. On a personal note, my sister Laurel, before she passed away a few years ago, was a university professor and often taught a class about the Vietnam era, teaching students about the history and upheaval that took over the country at that time. Joe was a frequent guest speaker in my sister's class, so it feels as though I am in some way completing the circle by interviewing Joe. The students killed on that day were Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Schauer, and William Schroeder. Joe has always been generous with his time and reflections about that day because, as he says, he is speaking out because those who were killed cannot. Welcome, Joe, to this maiden voyage of the Benders of the Ark podcast.
I was a freshman at the time of the Kent State shootings, and I was, like a lot of people, opposed to the war in Vietnam and trying to find an outlet to express my rage and discontent with government policy. And so in high school, we would see Walter Cronkite on the news all the time. And before the days of news censorship like we have now, you would actually see and hear wounded GIs on the news at night. And they were men who were dying from bullet wounds on TV from our country's misguided efforts to control the outcome of elections and Vietnam's future. And that outraged me. And I was raised in the Catholic Church, and the Catholic tradition, of what's right is right, and what's morally reprehensible is war in places where it's not even in self-defense. And so I was outraged, even in high school. And so when I came time to go to college, I participated in anti-war activities and listened to some SDS stuff, although they had interesting
Students for Democratic Society.
Students for Democratic Society had some visits to the campus, and they were a presence at Kent State, although I wasn't a member some of the folks around and other ones who were involved were. And so I was present on the day and a witness to what happened when the Ohio National Guard was deployed to Kent State's campus in May of 1970. It followed close on the heels of Nixon's, and I'm going right to the history here, Jeff. April 30th, 1970, Nixon declared that troops had gone into Cambodia, and people who were opposed to the war, like myself, considered that to be an expansion of the war, and were up in arms and demonstrated against it all over the country. And I remember hearing about it on a ticker tape machine at Taylor Hall on Kent State while I was walking around with my girlfriend at the time. A ticker tape machine is something that's an antiquated piece of machinery now, but it was fascinating then to be able to read this news that was new, fresh, coming across the wire. And as a result of that, there was a small demonstration on campus the following day, which I heard about, that they buried the Constitution because they said Nixon had killed the Constitution going to war without the approval of Congress. It's become commonplace now, of course. But so there was a demonstration to bury the Constitution, and they said we'll have another get-together, another demonstration on Monday, the following Monday. And that word spread through word of mouth that there was a planned action. So I was on campus. I didn't attend that demonstration, but I heard about it. I also heard about another planned demonstration that a couple of anti-war guys had planned. And I don't remember, I think it may have actually been before the Cambodian incursion, but a couple of these guys, one of whom later was also wounded at Kent State, they planned this demonstration for the Commons, which was a central area in the university. The university was large, 24,000 students. So the central area was like a big soccer field. They called it the Commons. And these guys, Robbie Stamps and what's the other guy's name? I can't remember right now, but they planned this demonstration and they put out the word far and wide across the campus. They were going to napalm a dog. We're going to napalm a dog. And people were outraged. And so more students showed up in anger to protest this action than, of course, would be there to support it. And that was exactly their point. So look at all of you here who are so angry because we said we were going to napalm a dog, and yet this war is going on in Vietnam, and we're napalming humans every day. So their action was, you know, I think significant and well-placed. So then, you know, at this time, another historical reference, it was early spring, May 1970, and there was a Senate seat up for grabs in Ohio. And the Republican candidate for Senate was the governor of Ohio. He was going to run in the Republican primary, James Rhodes. And he was running on a law and order ticket against John Glenn for the Republican primary of Senate. The election, the primary day would have been May 5th. And so he was campaigning on a law and order strict ticket. And when disruptions happened on campus, he was very vocal about opposing them and how he was going to stop, you know, these actions from happening. Well, partially as a result of the Cambodian incursion, and partially because of missteps by the Kent mayor, Friday night in Kent, there was a bit of a disruption. And Kent had, it was a fantastic little city. It had 28 bars and 5 blocks. Most of them had live music. And for people our age, you would maybe know the James Gang was there. Joe Walsh was a student at Kent State, and so every weekend his band, the James Gang, played along with other bands in downtown Kent. So this Friday, was May 1st was a nice spring day. A lot of students were downtown drinking. They had 3-2 beer, which you could drink at 18. Mm. A big appeal for college students. And so the bars were full, but somebody began a ruckus in the streets. And it may have been, you know, an attempt to protest the Cambodian incursion. It may not have been. I didn't see it. I don't know what exactly happened, but they disrupted the traffic flow in the streets. And someone lit a bonfire in a 55-gallon drum, and they said it's going to be a street party, you know, and made the announcement. And so a little crowd of people gathered. There was some racing of a motorcycle and cars through town, I heard. But the mayor of Kent, Leroy Satram, made the misguided decision that around 11 o'clock on this Friday night, because of the disruption that was happening, he closed the bars. And so all the bars closed, resulting in thousands of disgruntled students going out into the streets. It's almost like there was an intent to try and foment some kind of trouble. And I'm very suspicious about who got their way all in all through the whole weekend. And so the streets were flooded with people. There were some windows broken. There was some other activity by police. And I believe that through the back channels, there was information transmitted to Columbus, to the governor's office, about trouble. We have trouble here in Kent. And so that was Friday night. Now, Saturday, I was on campus. So James Rhodes was running as a law and order candidate for governor, or for senator from Ohio. Republican in the Republican primary. And so after Friday night's disruption, I'm sure his office got notice from the mayor's office about things that were happening. And if you remember that time, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not it was appropriate to have ROTC on college campuses. And the anti-war folks, like myself, considered it kind of a violation to have ROTC on campus. So there was a rumor that the ROTC building at Kent was going to be targeted that following night, and sure enough, it was. And so I watched, the ROTC building was right across the commons from my dormitory where I lived, and so I just went out the door of my dormitory, and I could see people approaching as night fell, people approaching the ROTC building, first a small crowd, then a larger crowd, trying to set the building on fire, and not very successfully. People said, let's go around the campus and get some more people to join us. And so I followed behind this crowd as we went all around the Kent State campus, and it took, you know, a good half hour, 40 minutes as we went around the campus. When we came to the front of the campus, to Highway 59, as we got there to the front part of campus on the grassy hills, the National Guard was coming in from the armory in Ravenna to the east. And they had trucks with troops, and they had half tracks, and they had jeeps, and they came rolling in. And so we all just left. I left that area immediately, headed back to my dorm. And by the time I got back to my dorm, the ROTC building was fully involved in flames. So it kind of mysteriously went from a failed attempt to a successful attempt to ignite the building. And I've always been suspicious because my former wife, well, she's passed away, my first wife, was a paralegal researcher for the ACLU. And she found radio logs that said there were messages to the fire department not to come yet, not to come yet. And so it seems like there was a plan that this building was going to be burned. And while students were arrested for it, I'm not sure exactly who was culpable for the successful burning of the ROTC building. And I watched it from my friend's dorm room, because mine was across the hall. So I went across the hall and watched out his window as this building, it was a wooden building built after World War II, and it was, you know, it was really old. And in fact, it had been pressed into service because of lack of funds on the university's part to hold class in it. And I watched it as it burned, and I'll never forget the Buffalo Springfield song For What It's Worth playing on the radio at the same time, and they couldn't have coordinated it any better. But the building burnt to the ground, And so Saturday night, this building went away, and then Sunday morning, my parents called me to tell me to be safe, and I told them I was fine, I was not in any trouble. Well, the National Guard had arrived en masse that night.
So did the fire department show up to fight the fire?
Fire department showed up and tried to fight the fire. Some people interfered with them, cut the hoses, and fought them back. And there was a lot of police presence at first. Eventually there was, and they got the fire. They didn't really get the fire out. The building burned down. There was some interference with the firemen, and people got arrested for that who were suspected of doing that, too. So in the morning, we woke up to the ashes of the ROTC building being guarded by armed National Guardsmen with fixed bayonets and helmets and rifles lined up in front of this building. And it was a sunny Sunday afternoon, and the Kent State campus has... It was 2-1 co-eds to guys at that time. And so the campus was kind of quiet, but there were people walking around, and class was in session. And the guardsmen were standing there, and I have some interesting photos I can share with you. Guardsmen were standing around with their jeeps and their helmets and their rifles, chatting it up with co-eds who were walking by, and guys, you know, talking to the guardsmen who were there, you know, because they had to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the story goes, and I heard it confirmed by her boyfriend, that Allison Krauss, who was later killed, walked up to one of the guardsmen and put a lilac blossom in the barrel of his gun and said, "Flowers are better than bullets."
Mm.
And he, of course, got reprimanded by his commanding officer who was nearby and had him remove that. But I heard the story repeated by her boyfriend, who happened to be my mailbox partner in the dormitory, because his name was Barry Levine. I'm Joe Lewis. It was alphabetical. And so I saw Allison Krauss almost every day, and she was attractive in every way.
Hmm.
She was 19. And so the guardsmen were there on Sunday. It didn't seem to be like a menacing situation, except for the fact that they all had lots of weapons. There were 900 guardsmen bivouacked on the practice soccer field, and they were all around the campus. And then that night, there was a curfew. It was 10 o'clock in the city and 11 o'clock on campus. But the plan was to have classes as usual on Monday. So it didn't really seem to jive to have this occupation and have classes as usual. I mean, I worked all my high school career, my whole high school time, to save money for 1 year of college, and that was it. And so I planned to go to school, the college, or go to class. And so that Sunday night, as it got dark, they began to enforce the curfew. And it was pretty terrifying for a civilian, because there were three helicopters with searchlights overhead patrolling around, and there was tear gas clouds all over the campus where the guardsmen were chasing people. But the first thing that happened, and Russell used to tell this part of the story because he was there, he went down just off the front of the campus where I had been when the guardsmen arrived. And they wanted to have a peaceful demonstration. They wanted to speak to the mayor of the city and the president of the university. And so a group of people got out there and made their demands known. And someone told them, "Okay, sit down here peacefully and we'll get the mayor and the president to come and speak to you." And so they sat there and they, you know, sang protest songs and were peaceful and stayed in place. And the guardsmen had surrounded them on all sides until the time that the curfew went into effect, which was off the campus. It was 10 o'clock. So as 10 o'clock arrived, the guardsmen lobbed tear gas into the crowd and started shuffling them off at bayonet point back onto the campus. And there were stories, and there are people who were bayoneted that night, who were clubbed with rifle butts, and who were assaulted by guardsmen that night. What I saw back at the dorm area was these helicopters overhead, and it was like being my best imagination of what being in a war zone would be like. Mm-hmm. Because their tear gas clouds were going around campus, and these helicopters with searchlights flying overhead, and then the guardsmen were lined up shoulder to shoulder, hustling kids, you know, at bayonet point into the buildings. And our resident counselor, Lou Jeffries, at Johnson Hall there, he was held a door open, and he was hustling students in. He said, because you could go into our dorm and then out the other side and go to your dorm, wherever it was. And so he was hustling people in, telling them, come here. Even if you don't live here, at least get out of harm's way. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So students were pouring in through that door and then maybe going down the hall and out the other way. And he told the story later that night when I talked to him, that as he brought this last kid who was right in front of the guardsman with bayonets, pulled him into the door and pulled the panic bar shut on the door, the guardsman lunged with his bayonet and the knife got stuck in the door. He was so anxious to get at this student, get at this kid. And it just kind of demonstrated the mindset. Well, so the guardsmen came around the dormitories, and they were getting jeered at from the windows, and people were yelling stuff and maybe throwing stuff, but mostly yelling stuff. And so I saw guardsmen pick up stones and throw them at the dormitory windows, you know. And so I remember the discussion I had with Lou that night was, it's hard to tell who's wearing the white hats and who's mm-hmm. wearing the black hats, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of bad things being going on in both ways. We also talked about whether or not those rifles would be loaded with live ammunition, and thought, of course, they wouldn't have any reason to have live ammunition. And, you know, not knowing any better, I thought they would have blanks in them. But, of course, mm-hmm. that, looking back now, that's preposterous. I mean, mm-hmm. but I never saw a need for any weapons or live ammunition there, so I didn't expect that they would have. And we talked about that night. And during the day, Sunday, during the day, this is prior to that time, prior to that night, setting the mood for that night, perhaps, Governor Rhodes came to the Kent Fire Hall, and he gave this very emotional and fiery speech while he banged his fist on the table, and you could hear that in the recordings. They talked about how he was going to do everything in his power to keep the campuses of Ohio open, even if it took an armed guard in every classroom. And he banged his fist on the table, and he said, these student agitators are going from campus to campus like as if we were an organized mob.
Right.
And what I always said about Russell and me is we weren't terrorists, we were smartasses. You know, and he said, they're going from campus to campus, and we're going to stop them if you know, whatever it takes. And so I think that raised the ire of the guardsman, who could also hear his speeches, and he kind of set the tone along with Nixon.
Well, it reminds me of Reagan, who was governor of California at the time, who was doing much the same thing.
Behaving very much the same way. Interesting note, because I thought that Reagan might be the winner here, but the governor of Ohio, James Rhodes, called up the National Guard more than any other governor of any state, including Reagan. I thought Reagan might be probably a close second. But Russell had an experience that night, too, with the curfew, because he was standing on his lawn in front of the fraternity house where he lived. And I have photos. I have a photo of this. And he's standing there, and the guardsman said, you know, okay, there's a curfew, move along. And Russell says, I pay property taxes on this piece of grass right here, and I'm not going anywhere. And so the guy pulled out his billy club and smashed him on the knee, and he fell to the ground. And this is the smart-ass part. I'm so proud of Russell. He stumbles back up on this one good leg, and he goes, and the guardsman said to him, well, I guess you'd be moving along now. And Russell said, only going to the other ground if you hit me in the other knee. And so I think that set him up as a target possibly later. But but he was a smart-ass, not a terrorist. And so Sunday night, went to bed. It was very frightening. Maybe the most frightening time of my life was with those helicopters overhead and the tear gas and the sweeping of the campus at bayonet point. And so Monday, there was a noontime rally scheduled. Classes as usual. And so I did go to a class or two in the morning, and then I wanted to participate in the rally to show my objection to the invasion of the campus by the National Guard. At this point, it wasn't so much about Vietnam, but it was about the militarization mm-hmm. of our campus. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to lend my body, at least in number, to support the effort to protest and show these guys that we didn't appreciate having them there, wanted them to leave. So I went out. It was right outside my dorm again, right down to the commons. There was a bell that they used to ring for the odd athletic victories, but it was also a rallying point for demonstrations, so the victory bell, they called it. The victory bell rang around noontime, and people assembled on the commons, about 1,200 students, and the National Guardsmen were lined up across the commons field in front of that burned-out ROTC building as if they were going to protect the ashes from further harm or something. And there was a rule, which I don't think I really knew the details of because it was classes as usual, but I think there was a rule that they were going to enforce no gathering of four more students on the campus. So here we are, 1,200 students objecting to their presence, and the guard started to they sent a jeep out with a bullhorn, and a person read the riot act to this Kent State students, and it said, "Students of Kent State, this is an illegal assembly. Return to your dormitories." And of course they were met with jeers and shouts and upraised middle fingers and you know, just a negative response, you might say. And they did it two more times. Each time the crowd got a little louder in their rebellious response to, like, "No, you're the ones who are in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. We're here to go to school. This is our school. We're paying tuition. It's classes as usual." But and so they weren't successful in breaking up the crowd by the use of the bullhorn. Mm-hmm. So nine or so guardsmen stepped forward with tear gas launchers, and they fired tear gas towards a crowd of students. And the students were across the field and up a hill. And the hill, the top of the hill, was a building called Taylor Hall. And it was the house, it housed the College of Architecture and the College of Journalism. And so there was a lot of cameras around from journalist students as well as other cameras. And so the whole story about the Kent State shootings is documented well on film. It's black and white film, but there's lots of photos to show you, for instance, the difference between the demeanor of the students and the demeanor of the guardsmen, and what they were prepared to do, and how they were dressed and how they behaved. And so the guardsmen fired these tear gas canisters across the field at students, and the wind wasn't really blowing in a good direction for them. It kind of blew it back towards them, and some students got brave and covered their mouths with the wet rags and picked up the canisters and threw them back. And it became a very bizarre, the way I described it in the past, it was a bizarre tennis match where you would boo when the tear gas canisters came your way, and you would cheer when they were returned back the other way. I know it just struck me as so bizarre that that's what it was like. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't like a sense of impending doom, like it maybe should have been. And so after that failed to disperse the students, the guard formed up in lines, and they started to move out towards a crowd of students. And so the students, of course, I mean, we were, some of us, partly college educated, so we got the hell out of the way as they came forward with their bayonets, you know, at the ready. And students streamed up both sides of the hill around Taylor Hall and down to the other side in front of the building. And the guardsmen likewise followed up that hill, went between, like, separating groups of students, they went between them and down to a flat on the other side of the hill, on the other side of Taylor Hall, which was a little practice football field. And so there's dormitories, Taylor Hall, other dormitories. They passed through these buildings and down to this practice football field, which had a chain link fence on three sides of it. So they got down to the practice football field. turned around and looking back up the slope to this gathering of students, and with their bullhorn, they announced, "Students of Kent State, we have you surrounded." Well, what we saw was a chain link fence around three sides of them, and then, you know, 1,200 students overlooking them from the hilltop, and it seemed like they were mistaken. There was kind of like a little chuckle. I mean, it was like a, what are you talking about, kind of response from the crowd of students. And then they focused on the far side. It would be the, I want to say, the east side of that practice football field. There was a lot more vocal protesters over there, people yelling at them. And maybe throwing some things. There was some rock throwing, but I'm talking about gravel. And I always like to say that no guardsmen were injured that day. So keep that in mind when you talk about there was some rock throwing. No one got hurt. But there was also Alan Canfora down there, and he had a black flag that he was holding. And the guardsmen, I'm sure, considered that to be taunting them. But his reason for holding the black flag was he was from Barberton, Ohio. And just a week or two before, one of his friends from high school had been killed in Vietnam. And so he was holding a black flag in memory of his friend. Well, in response to him standing there with the black flag, several guardsmen, half a dozen or more, knelt down and aimed their rifles at him, aimed their rifles in that direction, and at the loud protests that were going on beyond him and behind him. So that I think that section of the crowd got a special attention and targeted, perhaps, later. And so I was still up on the hillside after I separated. They went down, and I came back together. I was just overlooking the guardsman position down on the practice football field while they were looking over this way. And then there was a little huddle of a half a dozen, perhaps officers, and I don't know what was said or what the decision was made, but I think there was some decision made. And what happened then was they got up and started to retrace their steps back the way they had come, which appeared to the students like we had won. They were leaving, you know, they had managed to separate some students and they had maybe finished their mission and they were going to leave. But as they turned to get up and return and retrace their steps, they were coming exactly back right in my direction, because I had filled in the spot that they had passed through. And so they started walking directly towards me, so I, of course, moved to the side out of their way, but I was very near to them, and I could hear their equipment jostling as they hustled back up the steps, and they had on gas masks, you know, and helmets, bayonets fixed under rifles, M1 Garands, and they kept looking back very sharply over their shoulder at that group on the east side of the parking lot area and where Alan had been. As they climbed the hill, they were still looking back that way. And they passed right in front of me. And as they came past me, they came to the corner of the railing at Taylor Hall. Now, I didn't hear it.
You were out in front of Taylor Hall?
I was in front of Taylor Hall, and as it turned out, I was very near to them when they came back in front of me, so that I was about 70 feet away. They reached the corner of the railing of Taylor Hall, and there's a recording that is an order to fire, which I didn't hear at the time, but there was a tape recording made of the incident that you can hear it. But what I saw was when the first gunman got to the corner of the railing, the three of them turned in unison all at once. Like there had to be either an order or an agreement that when it had got there, they would turn. And so they turned and aimed their rifles back at the position where I was. And I was 18. I was not a terrorist either, but I was a smart ass. And so when they aimed their rifles at me, I gave them the finger like this. And I never expected that there would be anything to come of that. Because, you know, they're law enforcement trained. They should be used to a little harassment. I didn't really think it through. But they aimed their rifles. I gave them the finger. And I started to hear sounds, which I had no idea, you know, what they were. But I saw the ground in front of me puff up in little puffs of dirt. And that's when I realized they were shooting live rounds. At the same time that I noticed that, I was shot the first time. And the bullet entered my abdomen. and knocked me back through the air and exited through my hip and left me laying on the ground. And in testimony in our civil trial years later, there was a second guardsman who also said he shot me. He said that he shot someone who had already been shot once, and that bullet went through my lower left leg, just above the ankle, through in one side and out the other. And when the lawyers in that trial asked him, why would you shoot somebody who had already been shot, you know, as if he should come up with some defense for attempted murder, he said, well, everyone else was shooting him. That was his response. So that was pretty damning, I think. But as I lay there, I fell to the ground, and the shooting was 13 seconds of gunfire, 67 shots, they figure. Mainly 8 people did the firing into the crowd. Others may have fired, but we concluded that mainly 8 men.
8 out of?
Out of probably on that hilltop, probably 35 or so on the top of the hill. Maybe more than that. I have photos, actually.
Now, I remember reading something about that I thought the first person to fire was one of the officers with a pistol.
The first image that you'll see in the photos is a sergeant, left-handed, with a .45 caliber pistol. And Sergeant Pryor is his name, and he's passed away. But he said that he never fired his pistol until he found out that there were photographs. And I didn't know this about a .45, but when a .45 shoots, the sling comes back and reloads another round in the chamber, so that each time it's fired, the round barrel is exposed. And so the photographs, after he said he hadn't fired it, the photographs proved that he fired it like 3 times, because the barrel was exposed 3 times as he fired his left-handed pistol. So that may have been a signal, but subsequent recording analysis sounds like an order to fire. So I was on the ground, and no medic or guardsman came to me, but a student came up to me and realized that he knew that I was a classmate of his sister's from high school. And I asked him, I said, how bad is it? Because I couldn't sit up. I said, how bad is it? And he said, oh, it's just a flesh wound. Because I think he saw the hip injury, which is the exit wound. And so I was relieved by that lie, but I still couldn't get up. And then a girl came over to my side and held my hand. And a couple other students came around. And then I laid there. I laid there until sometime later the ambulances came and took us to Robinson Memorial Hospital. Curiously, the body's ability to protect itself in shock, I didn't lose consciousness the whole time, which is stunning. To me, because I was in the ambulance and I saw friends of mine come up to the window and wave to me. But I thought I was dying. I thought I was going to die. And I thought, well, you know, I'm only 18. I didn't really think it completely through this way, but I hadn't done anything terrible in my life. But I thought, just in case, I'm going to say that act of contrition that I learned in church, you know, just to cover all the bases. And so I did. But I was in the ambulance with another student who had been shot, John Cleary, and he'd been shot in the lungs. And he was in terrible, terrible, mortal pain. And as we rode to the hospital, it wasn't far, it was only 10 miles, but every bump and every turn, he was just screaming out in bloody murder. He was in such horrible pain that it actually freaked me out that he was suffering so bad. And then the last thing I remember when I got to the hospital, an orderly or someone said, we're going to cut off your clothes. And I remember thinking, Mom's not going to be happy about that. So I came to a couple of days later fighting for my life in the intensive care unit with John Cleary, who had been in the ambulance with me on one side, and Dean Kaler on the other side. And Dean was a farm boy. I was 6'3". I was the shortest one of the three of us. So all our feet stuck out the ends of the intensive care beds. But Dean had been an athlete in high school, and he was a farm boy. So he knew when he heard the guns, he was familiar enough with rifles, he knew that that was rifle fire. So he was a couple hundred feet away, and he jumped down on the ground, and he was laying prone on the ground when the bullet severed his spinal cord and paralyzed him for life. And he's the most amazing human being that I've ever met. He's most amazing. He's from the Church of the Brethren. And so it gave him an attitude of forgiveness that we could not understand for a long time. And he still suffers a great deal physically for things that happened to him that day. And he's my example of being tough. He's tough. So I was in hospital 3 weeks and a day. And I came home to my family's house in Massillon, Ohio. And shortly afterwards, there was an article in the paper that in the local paper, hometown paper, in the Massillon Evening Independent, that talked about the Kent State shootings. And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting to read. And I opened it up and read it. And it talked about how students were attacking guardsmen with bricks and bats and bottles, overturning cars, none of which was at all true. And I thought, oh my God, my neighbors are reading this about what they think, you know, happened there. So that was very disturbing. And the actual result of the experience at my experience at Kent State was I don't believe the media or the government anytime ever anymore. So I am lucky to be alive. There's four people who aren't alive: Allison and Jeff, Sandy and Bill. And the reason that I'm always willing to talk about it is because they can't.
Yeah.
And Sandy and Bill weren't necessarily activists. They were going to class, maybe very, very innocent of any wrongdoing. And Jeff and Allison...
One of them was in ROTC, weren't they?
Yeah, Bill was in ROTC. Although I think they suspect he had come around to opposing the war in Vietnam eventually. But Allison and Jeff were more activists. Not that they deserved any punishment for that, but they were probably involved in anti-war demonstration as opposed to the other two. But they were all 300 feet away or more. And the guardsmen said, after they were sequestered for a month, first of all, they said there was a sniper that they were responding to. Then that turned out to be not true. Then after they were sequestered for a month, the guardsmen all came out with the same story. They were afraid for their lives, so they had to fire to save their own lives. That was the common statement. So that's the description of that weekend. But it's had a huge impact on me, like I said, on my attitude and on my body, you know. But I feel lucky to be alive, and I've made some real lifelong friends with the Kent State families.
Right, right.
We go back every year for the commemoration, and it's like a bittersweet reunion. And a lot of my family is still there in Ohio, too.
You know, there was a lot of, like you say, rhetoric from Governor Rhodes and the mayor, as well as from Reagan in California. But there was sort of a common rhetoric about calling the protesters bums or un-American. How do you think that influenced it did that make a difference? And was that the reason that it happened? Do you think that was a cause?
I think there was a maybe not the direct cause, but I do think it led to that kind of rhetoric, led to seeing the students engaging in illegal activities. Although we were not, we were peaceful. I was motionless and silent when I was shot. We were exercising our free speech rights to assemble peaceably, and you know, the Constitution guarantees that we're allowed to dissent from our government opinions, especially when it comes to a war that's unjustified. And I think that that the rhetoric from all from those powers that be led to most people in the country blaming the students for what happened. And a lot in Ohio, especially, a lot of the townspeople said they should have shot them all, should have shot more. They got what was coming to them. Mm-hmm. And if they say that, they weren't there. They didn't know the scene. They didn't know that there was a peaceful assembly of students faced with a riotous, heavily armed, and poorly prepared and poorly trained group of soldiers. And it's still going on today when we talk about the militarization of police. You know, we want to have a police protect us. Mm-hmm. Not enslave us, you know.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, so what do you think the lessons are that we should take from that experience for today?
Well, I think there should be a better understanding of accepting different points of view. I think we need to work together to solve problems that we face mutually in our country, and I think we need to understand what's happening internationally to a little deeper perspective, and not just jump at the rhetoric that is being applied or forced down our throats. You know, I think we need to make fact-based decisions. We need to know about the facts about what's happening, and the facts about what happened in the 60s and 70s. Because these are peaceful demonstrations that were assaulted by riotous enforcement.
Yeah. Did you ever have any contact with any of the guardsmen?
A good question, and I've been asked it before, because Russell and I were just a couple of the people who actually knew from their testimony the names of the men who shot us. People ask me, would you ever talk to them? And I would if we could have a discussion that led to the truth. But the guy who shot me first has since passed away, and I don't celebrate that, because I wish that he could have come to an understanding of telling the truth about what really happened. Because he said, and I never spoke with him, because he always stuck to his line that he was afraid for his life. He said he could see my right hand, but he didn't know it was in my left hand. Like, maybe I had a bazooka. I don't know what he thought. But he said he was afraid for his life, and both he knows, or he knew, and anyone who was there, and I know, that wasn't true. That when you have someone who's 65 or 70 feet away, silent and motionless, giving you the finger, that your life is not in danger, especially if you've got an M1 Garand in your hand with fixed bayonets,
right,
tear gas, and army, and, you know, a flak, steel pot helmet. So, so he would have known, and so I did never speak to him about that, and I don't think it could have done any good with his attitude being what it was.
As far as you know, no one has.
Oh, there has been conversation between Alan Canfora and. Well, Colonel Fassinger has spoke to him, and I think that Fassinger, who was there on the scene that day, I don't think that they ever came to any kind of understanding. But I know that Alan Canfora and Fassinger spoke several times. But you know, I don't think they ever came to any mutual agreement or understanding of what happened. So many people say there should be sympathy for the guardsmen too, for what they had to live through, but I'm in a position that makes it difficult for me to have much sympathy for them, because you know, four people were killed and they were 19 to 20 years old,
right?
And people say, so now after all this time you would dredge this whole thing up. Well, the fact is it gets worse with time, because now I'm a grandpa, and they could be grandparents if they had been allowed to survive that day.
Right Yeah. Well, this has just been great, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
For this opportunity to share your story with me, and I'm really grateful for this.
Sure. I hope that it serves you well in putting together some kind of description of events and the long arc of justice. I hope it served us both well.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As a postscript, neither the Ohio National Guard, their officers, nor any of the soldiers have been held responsible for the killing and wounding of students on that day in 1970. As you heard in Joe's own words, the media and most of the public opinion believe that the students provoked the violent response from the National Guard.
Criminal charges against the 8 guardsmen who fired their weapons were dismissed by the judge for lack of evidence. The victims and their families did file a civil lawsuit against the guardsmen, the state of Ohio, and the president of the university. The judge showed extreme bias in that case, and the jury voted against compensating the victims. Ultimately, the victims and their families did receive a small amount of money, most of which they gave to Dean Keller, who was permanently paralyzed from his wounds. The family of the students that were killed received only $15,000 each for their loss. This is certainly a cautionary tale of militarized policing, one that has only expanded into our cities throughout the country. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Benders of the Ark podcast. The introductory and closing music is from Joshua Campbell, titled Sing Out, March On. Thank you for joining us.
I'm gonna march on, and everybody said
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other
foot. Yes, I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. I got to keep on going, yeah.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.